Welcome to Library Voices SC. This is Curtis Rogers. I'm the Communications Director here at the South Carolina State Library. And Library Voices SC is the official podcast of the South Carolina State Library. And today I am very pleased to have with us in the studio Marvin Lehr. He is the editor of Volume 1 and soon to be 5 volumes of some wonderful text called Champions of Civil and Human Rights in South Carolina. And this volume one is Dawn of the Movement Era, 1955 to 1967, which we're going to be chatting about today. But I'd like to welcome Marvin to our studio.
Thank you. Very good to be here, Curtis.
It's great to have you. So you were here recently, and you were doing a presentation, which is part of our Speaker at the Center series, and that's the South Carolina Center for the Book here at the State Library. And you were doing some readings and talking a little bit about this new book that has been recently published by the University of South Carolina Press. And before we get into the book, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe what got you interested in this subject.
Well, I could probably blame it on my sister, Norma, who proceeded to be about 5 years ahead in school. And she did a declamation contest on civil rights and capital punishment, a variety of those things. And so it was very natural that admiring her and following somewhat in her footsteps then in college. I majored in sociology and also had friends and associates in the Methodist Youth Fellowship and the district program, including Jim Lawson and Phil Lawson, who were compatriots of Martin Luther King. And also in college, I became involved with an organization, a pacifist organization, the Fellowship for Reconciliation, which originated way back in World War I, much before my time, let me say. But nevertheless, the leadership of that organization, and particularly working with its director in Ohio, where I grew up, Glenn Smiley and his wife Helen. I found then that not too many years after that, he was pictured in the background with Martin Luther King at the Montgomery bus boycott. And so that pacifist organization was a very strong leader in civil rights in the early days.
And I guess what's so interesting, and what I find is interesting every time I meet an author or an editor who is working on this subject, is here we are, we're both Caucasians, you know, both white men, and you know, how did you get interested into this? Because coming from the white perspective or the Caucasian background, mm-hmm. and the white history, how did you get interested in this topic and, realize that it's something that needs to be in this kind of multi-volume series?
I'm a United Methodist minister, retired now for some years, and I pastored student charges in Ohio and then in Texas. I graduated from SMU and went on to seminary there. I pastored an inner-city interracial congregation in Los Angeles, St. Paul United Methodist Church, in the early 60s. And it was a very natural segue into civil rights activities, being in a fairly newly integrated congregation. And from that base, well, I became involved in many ways, including in the march from Selma to Montgomery with Dr. King and the thousands who were a part of that. And it was very natural that I flow into civil rights issues. And then when I returned to Dallas, my home conference, they were seeking to develop an urban ministry, and I had background in urban inner-city work, and so I headed the Dallas Inner City Parish, a group of churches and community centers in the inner city, and sort of the liaison between the black and white community, the inner city and the outer city, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. So later in the 60s, when it became appropriate for black leadership to take over what I was doing, I had to decide whether I was going to return to the traditional pastoral ministry or whether I was going to hold out for something in the inner city urban ministry. Mm-hmm. And my name got put in the hat in Columbia, South Carolina. I don't think I even knew there was a Columbia, South Carolina. I knew there was a Charleston,
South
Carolina.
So that's what brought you here.
Yes. So I came here in 1969 and headed up Community Care Incorporated, which is a interdenominational interfaith organization addressing emerging urban needs and issues, including school desegregation and drug abuse and the needs of the elderly and Meals on Wheels. And anyhow, we continued to identify emerging unmet needs and how the churches could bring their witness and service to bear on those.
Mm-hmm. So you were, that whole time frame, you were right in the thick of things.
Really was. And one of the most impactful and sad experiences was to attend Martin Luther King's funeral in Atlanta. Mm. But it really became a part of my portfolio, mm-hmm. Not a sideline or a interesting responsibility as a pastor normally would have, mm-hmm. but to be very much engaged in community change, addressing systemic violence and also misunderstanding, opening doors in so many ways.
And before we talk about the specific contents of the book, I tend to always view a lot of religious groups as being very segregated. You know, even today you have a lot of the black churches and the white churches, and then you have churches that are, you know, have a mixed congregation. And what are your thoughts on that? Have you always been a part of a congregation that was mixed race and just, you know, served everyone? Or
Most of my pastoral ministry in Texas and as a student in Ohio and all was to all white congregations. Mm-hmm. Now, in Ohio, we did not have segregated schools, and there were a few out of a large high school of 100 or 150 students or so. I would say that maybe 20% or so were black. Mm-hmm. And so it was not a strange kind of thing, but addressing the discrimination and the injustices which blacks in this country and across the country in many ways have endured. I don't think that I ran into that, except again that my sister, Norma, their class went for a skating party in Canton, Ohio. Hmm. And they were getting their skates on and being admitted. But then when one of the black members of their class showed up, the skating rink would not admit them. Mm. And so the whole class got up and left. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so even then, which would have been back in the 40s, wow. There were confrontations and mm-hmm. issues to be dealt with, even in the North.
Mm-hmm. And it is amazing, you know, when you look over time and a lot of the same issues crop up. And, you know, we have Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter and all of the mm-hmm. issues that deal with race and violence and police brutality and politics. And, of course, religion is in there, too. What kind of thoughts do you have about maybe the progress or the lack of progress that has been made?
Well, a great deal of the progress which was made during the Civil Rights Movement, which was amazing, probably one of the world's largest cataclysmic changes, basically with peaceful, nonviolent resistance. a lot of the changes in legislation, both at the state and local level, but in the federal level, broke a lot of ground. And so we can't minimize what was accomplished then, but even as we have seen so much in recent days, police-community relations is still a very tense and problematic issue in many communities. But even there in Los Angeles in the early 60s, I worked a great deal with the youth of the neighborhood, not just of the church. And youth gangs were on the rise. So some of my young people occasionally would have encounters with the police and all. And I left Los Angeles in June of 1965, and the riots, the massive Watts riots, were there in the late, in August of that same year. And I've always said, well, we always knew that something was going to happen. We didn't know where or when or how, but the tensions between the black community and the police were very present then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's unfortunate how a lot of things, you know, sometimes people will say the more things change, the more they stay the same, but hopefully we'll continue to see progress made in the areas of race relations in this country. Why don't we go ahead and talk a little bit about your volume one, and again, this is Dawn of the Movement Era, 1955 to 1967, and you start out, it's in three parts, and it looks like you start out with the 1954 Supreme Court ruling, and why did you decide to start with that?
Well, that really was a very watershed event in the whole nation. Actually, to come later, Volume 3 goes back to 1930 to 1954, and the pioneers, the visionaries that laid so much groundwork. But then the real watershed event was the Supreme Court's decision, and our own Judge Waits Waring from Charleston was a very pivotal figure in laying groundwork, which even though some of his wording was used in the Supreme Court decision, from his minority and his position, which was not accepted in his case, but which progressed and was certainly a part of the Supreme Court ruling then. So that seemed like a watershed point at which to begin and to date as being the beginning of the modern civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. And of course, South Carolina has a lot of important dates and contributions in the civil rights and human rights movements. So I definitely see an important list of, I'm looking at a sheet of paper here, important list of individuals' names, and you've got Thurgood Marshall and Matthew Perry, and you know, just the list goes on and on. And how did you, when you started doing your research, and it seems like you, for a five-volume set of books, I think you've probably been doing research most of your adult life.
Well, without knowing it, I was doing research for it, but it was not until I was about to retire in 2003 that I hit up on the idea of gathering these stories and doing oral history interviews so people could we could hear people in their own words and read exactly what they said and how they saw things. And so it was only then that I hit on. I was in a meeting, a board meeting of the Palmetto Development Group with a friend of mine from Charleston, Bill Saunders. And he asked me what I was going to do when I retired. And I gave him my standard joke that I was going to read a third of my time and garden a third of my time and write a third of my time and travel a third of my time. Well, he went right past the joke in that and asked, well, what was I going to write about? And I said, well, the interracial luncheon club that's been meeting here in Columbia since the early 60s when it was not kosher to meet together over meals and all. Had been wanting to have a history of it written. And then there were some theology issues that I wanted to address. And he said he had been doing some writing about the Charleston hospital strike in 1968-69. And he had played a major role of liaison between the local black hospital workers union and state government and Governor McNair at the time. And so his writings on that were a very important and critical thing to document and all. So on the way home from that meeting, I got to reflecting on how many of the civil rights leaders were passing from the scene, aging out, passing on. And I pulled over to the side of the interstate and jotted down in my notebook, Anthology of Civil Rights in South Carolina. I discussed it with him a few weeks later, and he said, no, it can't be just civil rights. It has to be civil and human rights, not just the legislative and the legal status of things, but the very humanity of people has got to be addressed. And so that's how I got started on champions of civil and human rights. And that word champions, I toiled a great deal over the what word advocate, leader, that kind of thing. And then I recalled that Larry Doby was a baseball player who in the American League was the first black to play in the American League in the with the Cleveland Indians, which I saw from time to time when the Lions Club took us to the game and all. So that word champions, and Larry Doby, as you may know, is from Sumter. No, I mean from Camden, South Carolina. And that word champions just locked in on me as being a very fitting term for this book, Champions of Civil and Human Rights in South Carolina.
Well, it certainly does fit. I mean, the list of names goes on, and I won't even try to read down the list. But we have the volume one here with us, and are there any parts of it that you would like to share with us, or anything that is particularly of interest to you that you'd like to share?
Yes, I think I'll read a couple samples that I think are particularly cogent. Your listeners may particularly know of the Reverend I.D. Quincy Newman, who along in the late 70s or early 80s, I believe it was, became the first black to be elected to the South Carolina State Senate, the first black since Reconstruction times. And all of his career and life was very committed to civil rights. And he was the executive director of the NAACP in South Carolina from the mid-50s to the mid or late 60s. And along in about 1982, Grace McFadden, who was the director of the African American Studies program at USC, interviewed him. And I'd like to read just a few paragraphs from his early childhood experiences. Dr. Grace McFadden says, "Is there anything, Reverend Newman, that sticks out in your mind that you can recall as a youngster that was a painful experience that dramatized the segregation that existed within your community?" "Yes," Dr. Newman says. "Yes, I remember one occasion as a small boy, my father sent me to the post office. As was his habit, whenever he sent us on an errand, he timed us, gave us so many minutes to go and come. And I was sent to the post office, and I ran all the way to the post office. On the way back, I got tired and sat in a chair in front of the fire department to rest. The fire chief, of course, was white, and came out in a rage, red as a beet, cursed me for everything he could think of, and told me that he what he would do to me if I didn't get out of that chair. That was a white man's chair, and no nigger was allowed to sit in that chair. He frightened me nearly to death. I'd never had that kind of experience before. That was in Kingstree, South Carolina. We had not long since moved to Kingstree from Anderson County. Up until that time, I didn't know that there was a race problem. I knew nothing but segregation. I knew nothing about segregation. What was a black man's place or a white man's place? And then there was another experience equally as traumatic or more so. We lived not far from the convict camp, the stockade, where prisoners were kept. And there was a man, a black man, who had been arrested. I don't remember what the crime was, but he was locked into a wooden calaboose, I believe they called it, with iron bars on the doors and windows. That night, the Ku Klux Klan visited this lockup where the black man was held, saturated it with gasoline or kerosene, and set it on fire. The man began calling for help in the middle of the night. Help! 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 I was awakened and went to my father's room, shook him to awaken him, and asked, Pa, ain't you going to go and help that man? My father said, go back to bed, boy. And I was insistent and shook him and said, Pop, go and help the man. But he didn't. I kept that in my heart for a long time and held it against my father. There was a man being burned alive, and my father wouldn't turn a hand to help him. Of course, I learned since that had he gone out to help this person in distress, he would have been shot down.
Mm.
So that was one of the childhood experiences of I.D. Quincy Newman that focused his life and career in ministry.
It really gives you goosebumps. I mean, to listen to that narrative, that experience that not only, you know, he had to deal with, but also what almost everyone in that time period had to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
I see you've got a few other areas marked in Volume 1 that you'd like to share.
Yes, and this one, it's rather surprisingly, comes out with some positive aspects. This is my interview with Reverend J.S. Neal, who pastored in Denmark and a number of places down toward Augusta and all. And in retirement, I interviewed him. And so I'll read a few paragraphs from it as well. I kept having meetings to build up my attendance because I was determined to make some adjustment, or they could just knock me out of the way. So I got them and the county to go down to the county seat one afternoon. And as they were standing in the door to watch, I go to the water fountain and drink. I guess about 25 or 30 of them down there. They stood around the door and looked. Somehow the news got around that we were coming, and when we walked in front of the door, the mayor was over here and the sheriff was over there, and they asked if they were going to drink from the fountain. All the folks had come to stand with me, and I was at the door. We didn't make it congested, but we just were there observing. When they came, I walked straight to the fountain and drank some water. I heard them say, now that's the word they use. They said, that's a crazy nigger, ain't he? I didn't think it over. I just went and drank the water and came back. Well, once one drink, it can't be no doubt about it. So no more was there any trouble about the drinking fountains. The next drive was integrating the theater. We had a little pigeonhole upstairs. We could go there and watch the show, but they, the whites, had to go down below. I kept working. I'm just giving you the main issues. I'm not talking about the other little petty things we ran into. These are the main ones. About a month after the drinking fountain, I kept on working. One Saturday morning, one of them, their race, not my people, they didn't call me, but one of them called me and said, Preacher? I said, yes, sir. how long are you going to be at home? I'm just using his words. I said, well, I'll be here a while. My children were across the street playing in the field. He said, well, I'll be out there. I want to talk with you. That's the only time that I got a little afraid. In my discretion, if a negative statement would come in, I did talk with my wife about it. I didn't do it immediately, though, because that doesn't pay off. I went on just like nothing had happened. Even in pastoring, I told my wife, I'm going to invite him in. If he does not come in, I guess I'll go and get in the car with him. I'm going. You watch, just to see what happens. So he drove up out there in the yard, and I said, won't you come in, sir? No, you come out here and sit down. So I went on out there and was sitting in the car right under the steering wheel and me in the front. I got in on the opposite side. He was by himself. So the two of us, after I got in, he said, now these are the exact words he said. He said, preacher? I said, yes, sir. He said, I'm a deacon in First Church here, and I know you're going to hear it, and I want to tell you myself, he said. For 2 years we've been trying hard to get you to kill you. And these were his words, if ever I said it. He said, but we couldn't get you to you. He goes on to recount that he always traveled with somebody else. So anyhow, he said, I knew you would eventually hear, but I wanted to tell you myself, he said. We were wrong, he said. We were wrong. If we had more 10 more men like you in this city, it would be better off. I did not discuss the situation with anyone but me and my wife and the Lord. He couldn't do nothing about it. And he said, and I said to him, I'm not angry with you. I wasn't. So we went on talking, and he said, I want to ask you a question. And I said, what's that, sir? He said, now on Wednesday of this week, you are going to integrate the theater, aren't you? I said, yes. Yes, sir, we plan to go anyway. He said, well, would you mind if me and my wife and your wife would go and be the first four to go into the theater there together?
Wow.
And I can definitely see why you did use the word champions, you know, mm-hmm. because these individuals, they're not only championing a cause, but they are individually champions and really, you know, so important to have their stories told like this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is always important to talk about, since this is Library Voices SC, uh-huh. is a little bit about libraries. And it can be, you know, I mean, maybe were libraries important during some of the civil and human rights movements in South Carolina? Or maybe what's your experience with libraries?
Well, quite varied as a student in high school and college. In high school, we had a bookmobile that came around to our school, was the primary library other than a few reference books and so on. But then, of course, through college and seminary, we'll quite often turn to the library. relative to this volume and this initiative, I'd have to say that a major resource was the Library of Congress. Hmm. The opening passages, which I have in this volume, are quotes from documents in the Library of Congress in the NAACP collection there. And so I made any number of trips there and searched for the documents which particularly applied to or were relative to South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very pivotal and very valuable resource, which you could not get just anywhere. Although I did discover later, too, that on microfilm, our library here at USC has most of the same documents.
Yeah, it is amazing what you can find in libraries. And so what I'm excited about and what I'm pleased with is, you know, being able to, working in a library, being able to be a part of that contribution to important researchers like you who take the time to really go through this and you know, get individuals to contribute their stories, but also what's, you know, the history and the research that goes into leading up to those stories. Mm-hmm. That also has mm-hmm. to be a part of it as well.
Well, the approach to the primary approach which I used, other than original documents from libraries and Howard University and other sources and all, my primary approach, though, was oral history interviews. Mm-hmm. And I would say that there are three different kinds of interviews. There's sort of the inquiring reporter who is pursuing a given subject or a given event and puts the microphone in front of the person and asks him some probing questions to get his response to it and so on. And then there's sort of the research kind of approach where you have a structured interview and ask the certain questions from that person, and then in many cases get the responses of a number of people to those same set of questions so that they can be compared and compiled and for research purposes. But oral histories is very different. Another name for it in modern times has been narrative analysis, where you take the words of the person themselves. And I always told people, well, I just want to start wherever you want to and end wherever you want to, include what you feel is important. And so with a oral history interview, you really get to know the person. You don't just get facts or information or have it structured in a certain way, but allow the person to really reveal themselves and reveal their experiences. And of course, they're just speaking from their heart. And people ask, well, did you have any problem with people having enough to say? And I said, virtually never. It was just like you dropped the phonograph needle on the record and all that was poured out that had been in them for years.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely amazing. Well, I want to go ahead and wrap up by saying thank you so much, not only for being here today, but also for taking on a project like this, because this is years and years of work that you have put into it and will continue, I imagine, for years and years to come, because this is such a large 5-volume set. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that it's important to recognize a couple of things is that, for one thing, I focused just on South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And often the South Carolina story is not recognized nationally because in many ways we avoided some of the disastrous confrontations in South Carolina that we think of in some of the other states. But yet some of the civil rights strongest leaders really came from South Carolina and led the movement across the nation. And then the other thing is to limit the time. 1930 to 1980, that's still a very large period of time, 50 years. Mm. But so the focus is limited. And then also, let me finish by saying that it seems like this is a very daunting book, 495 pages or something like that. However, the average interview is just 10 or 12 pages long, just 45 minutes to hour and 15 minutes or so. So it reads very quickly, and it's very interesting to see the ways in which the stories weave together on similar experiences and events and from various parts of the state.
Well, it's certainly an important piece that you know, researchers in the future, I'm sure, will be using more and more doing their research into this important topic. So again, we've been talking with Marvin Lehr here at the South Carolina State Library about Champions of Civil and Human Rights in South Carolina, Volume 1, Dawn of the Movement Era, 1955 through 1967. And this is available through the University of South Carolina Press. And we will include links to more information on our podcast page. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.